This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Monday and time for our monthly check-in. Monday with the Mayor, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, here in Studio 2. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Great to see you. I love your green and red print.
Thank you. Very holidays. Yeah, I figured it right. So we've begun the holiday season. So how was your Thanksgiving?
It was lovely. It was quiet and nice. We spent some time at Pine Street Inn and St. Francis House, and then thanks sushi giving with the family, and then a second day of ham and all the fixings with the kids. It was great. And tree lightings have begun in Boston, so I think I've done 9 or 10 so far.
Wow. How many will you do in total, do you think?
It ends up being around 40, I think.
Yeah. What's the most spectacular thing you've seen in a tree lighting so far?
So far this year, we had, last night was in Hyde Park, and they have a gigantic, beautiful tree that grows there, and the light's going all the way up. And it was pouring rain, just buckets down and down and down. And everyone still turned out with umbrellas. It was amazing to see. It kind of felt like that moment in The Grinch where everyone's still singing anyway, even though the weather is really awful.
Where all the Who's in Whoville come out anyway.
Right. It was beautiful.
All right, before we go on to the serious news, I need to know what sushi giving is.
Oh, thanks, sushi giving. So, I didn't grow up eating turkey on Thanksgiving. You come from an immigrant family. My parents always felt like turkey can be really dry, or maybe it was just the way that we were preparing it.
No, it can be dry.
So we, a couple years ago, started doing a pre-Thanksgiving dinner that is just platters of sushi, no cleanup, and everyone having a really good time.
And your favorite sushi? What's your favorite kind?
There is one at our local place called the Boston Roll. It has salmon and a special sauce in it.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Me, I like the ones that have a little lobster on top and maybe some of that, the crispy flake.
Oh, so you like the presentation.
And a bit of, as they say, crunch. It can be really nice. All right, let's go into news of the day. And I'm going to start with climate and the Prince and Princess of Wales, who are coming later this week. I understand that they're going to do a special event with you. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's very exciting. This is their first trip to the United States in 8 years and the first royal visit that Boston will have had from the British royal family since 1976 when the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, came. So we are preparing to celebrate the Earthshot Awards, which is Prince William's commitment that over the next decade, he is going to give out awards, basically the Oscars of climate innovation, celebrating and lifting up the foremost technologies around the world that give us a chance at solving climate change and repairing and restoring our planet. And so that will be Friday night. It's going to be an amazing week of really showing them just how much of this legacy Boston continues to lift up. We were host to President Biden's cancer moonshot announcement last month. Our hospitals and universities and innovators here still represent really the nation and the world's leading thinkers. And we're committed to big ideas. We always have been throughout the course of our history. So it'll be fun to really see that showcase with all of our work on climate as well.
So, I mean, you have declared Boston a Green New Deal city. You have a person who is the director of the Green New Deal. What do you want to show the Prince and Princess of Wales about Boston's progress on climate?
We here in Boston, as a coastal city, as a city where the impacts of climate are already here and visible and affecting people's lives in every which way, heavier rain, more flooding, more intense heat in the summers, we know that climate affects everything that we do, and therefore every action that we take as a city has to include climate progress. For us, climate is not only a set of challenges that we have to tackle and address head on, but really represents an opportunity for the next generation. The transitions that we're making in terms of our vehicle fleet and moving to electric school buses, or how we build housing and really prioritizing clean energy and security in your homes, these all represent jobs and a safer, healthier way of living. We know right now, for example, that the city's green energy program, our community choice electricity program, which I was proud to help implement starting several years ago and went into full effect about a year and a half ago. In today, when energy prices are going up around the world because of international conflicts and the price of oil and gas, our green energy program in the city of Boston that we help transition residents onto is more than $35 a month cheaper right now than the utility's basic default plan. And as their prices continue to go up starting next month, that gap will be even bigger. So we know that green is healthy. Green also saves money. And so it's really a win-win all around.
And I'm glad, excuse me, you brought up utilities. We actually do plan to talk with you about that a little bit more. I'd like to talk about winter in general in a little bit. I'm going to stay on this. I can't resist since you brought up the last time that Queen Elizabeth II was here. In September, when she passed, we spoke with former governor, Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. He was in his first term during that visit. And in retelling the day, he talked with us about something that happened as the Queen was getting off the royal yacht. Here he is.
And she began sliding down the gangplank and coming straight at me. And the one thing we had been told in being briefed about her visit was never touch her.
Goodness, and now she's barreling at you.
Well, here I am, and she's sliding down the gangplank at me.
Did you break into a sweat?
I'm not sure I broke into a sweat, but I wasn't going to let her fall. Fortunately, she came down the gangplank sliding, hit the deck with a bump, but didn't fall, and very politely said, good morning.
And he was very, right?
Oh my goodness.
I was a little surprised when he told us that story. He was very clear that there were clear protocols about what he was and wasn't to do. Have you had to prepare at all for the Prince and Princess of Wales? Are there protocols you've been told about? Is there anything you can and can't do? And if not, am I now freaking you out?
Maybe I should be preparing more. You know, there's certainly been a lot of preparations and working hand in hand with their team and with the JFK Library, which is the other host institution alongside the city of Boston. And we're really excited about the itinerary, the issues that will be discussed, the chance to walk and see some of the infrastructure up close, even leading up to the award ceremony later in the week. I think the Prince and Princess, William and Kate, represent a new generation of leadership and service as well. And so they, like myself, are millennials now with young kids. And I know that they represent an institution that is hundreds and hundreds of years old and has very intense traditions and history there. But they're also of our generation, and I can't wait to show them this new Boston, which is going to be just as excited as a visit from the prince's grandmother several decades ago.
So it was fun to get excited about that. We talked a little bit about climate. I do want to take a different piece of news from the last couple of days over the weekend, the Boston Globe reporting on a new task force on youth safety formed between the Boston Police Department, Boston Public Schools. Now, it was formed in mid-October. The group meets weekly to focus on outreach strategies for at-risk kids. The Globe got data from the Boston Police Department between January and October of this year. There were 102 juvenile gun arrests. And I want to put that in perspective. Last year, 67. In 2019, 36. So what is the aim here? And is the focus on guns first? Is it on the violence that we've seen in a set of neighborhoods over the last couple of months? What's the focus?
Our focus here, as with every issue that we're tackling across the city, is to not just stay at a high level, but really get down to the nitty-gritty and how we actually deliver impact. And in this case, that means sharing the strategies and building a plan around student by student, family by family, school by school, what is needed. We know that the public safety statistics are, in fact, a symptom, a reflection of underlying challenges in our communities across every category. And the trends have been that basically every way that we count those statistics, whether it's by type of crime or number of people involved, it has been on a steady decline. Last year was just about the lowest that there was in terms of homicides and shootings. And this year we are still slightly below last year's numbers. However, the one troubling trend, or one of the troubling trends, is that the number of juveniles, teenagers even, involved in every category of public safety incident, from shootings to robberies to assaults, has been higher in every category, even as the numbers overall are lower. And, you know, I have spent a lot of time over this last year in our schools, speaking directly with young people, with our educators, with our community. And it's clear that we put aside a lot of priorities during the pandemic. It was all hands on deck to save lives and keep people safe from COVID and deliver food and many of the most emergency needs. Much was dismantled in that period. The supports and after-school programs that used to exist were put on pause because people couldn't be together safely. Other infrastructure around social and emotional supports. And so it's been a long time in a child's life that they've had that level of disruption. And it's showing in how we're experiencing the impacts. And so this safety task force is really meant to knit people back together. It's 30 plus different agencies, not just public safety in schools, but public health, outreach, our counselors, and the strategies that we're implementing are around one-on-one counseling or mentorship or getting a child enrolled in an after-school program. So everything is on the table.
So I have three questions I really want to ask about this. And the first one is going to sound like I'm poking you to get an answer. But I'm not. Did we go too far? Do we know yet if we went too far in isolating kids with one public health objective in mind and now seeing other public health outcomes that are harmful? Do we know? Did we go too far?
I think you're measuring different parts of an individual's life, both of which are very important. And I think it's many people would say that the ultimate objective of saving people's lives had to come first. And we didn't know that much in the beginning about how to even treat COVID, just the knowledge and the ability to mitigate and protect people was exponentially increasing as every week went by, and especially as vaccines came online and distribution got ironed out. But there was so much initially that was meant just to keep people alive, and it's hard to go back and question that. Now, how long did that have to go on, and what were the mechanisms, and what could have really protected people, and what was kind of maybe overboard and we didn't have as much impact? You know, looking back, we can prepare for the next round. Unfortunately, as we know that, again, going back to climate, many of the pandemics that sweep the world come from diseases that tend to jump from animals to humans, so-called zoonotic diseases. And those are more and more frequent as animal habitats are being encroached upon by humans. And so this won't be the last pandemic, unfortunately. We have learned a lot about how we need supply chains to be able to get up and running, information to get out much more quickly, validators on the ground so that key communities who have been disenfranchised and historically marginalized or even harmed by the medical community need to be brought in and leading the charge. We have learned a lot. But there's now, you know, I think it's impossible to go back and say we should have done this or that in the height of that emergency. We know what we need to do now. The city of Boston has brought on a new role focused on behavioral health. Dr. Kevin Simone is our city's first ever chief behavioral health officer, and he works closely with Bisola Ojukwutu, Dr. Ojukwutu of our Boston Public Health Commission, and they are on the verge of getting close to releasing their plan for youth mental health in particular. This has been a key area that we know will continue to have impacts, and mental health across the board for every generation is something that we still are picking up the pieces after the pandemic.
So my next question, we have had a number of conversations here about violence in the communities, the neighborhoods. Over the last couple of months, we've had, you know, Representative Liz Miranda, we've had Reverend Kevin Peterson, we've had Mariama White-Hammond. We had a high school student from the Burke who came in and talked to us. You've talked about the family-to-family, kid-by-kid wraparound approach here. Trust keeps coming up, especially between neighborhoods and the Boston Police Department. Is there a risk in taking this family-by-family, student-by-student approach that identifies kids, even if the goal is wraparound services? Is there a trust concern that this feels like a violation for families or kids? How do you walk that line so you identify kids who have needs, but it doesn't feel to communities like targeting kids?
That's why the approach is really, first and foremost, to break down silos between different departments. Because when we have a public safety issue that's addressed solely by law enforcement, it ends up not getting to root causes in many cases for our young people. And so we've had situations where transit police are in the room and they'll flag, for example, multiple weeks in a row at this particular station, we have seen fights break out between young people. And here's some of the names that we had taken down as we worked to break up those fights, actions that they would have taken anyway for public safety. But now making that connection to social services and our schools to be able to say, okay, actually, this means that this school community is impacted in some way. Can we get more coaching and counseling? Can we make sure that there's some direct outreach and listening, some circles in that school to have real conversations? It's had a huge impact so that we're actually bringing more services so that we have accountability and services in how we address the challenges that our young people are facing.
And let's talk about the gun piece last, and then we'll take a little break. These gun arrests, this is a lot more handguns. There's two framings on that. There's the traditional framing we often hear of the media, of kids and guns. Then there is the kids are afraid and are afraid through the areas that they're walking to go to school, afraid while they're in school, afraid outside of the school. Those guns are still available. So how do you go at that intersection of fear and sense of vulnerability for kids and the availability of weapons and keep that mental health piece in the middle while keeping a key criminal justice piece there too?
Yeah, that is really the trend nationally that is seeping into our city as well, is the sheer ease of access to weapons is really changing the stakes of every interaction. And we really focus on trying to understand, again, specific case by specific case, what happened? What was the family dynamic? What was the interpersonal dynamic? And often when you diagnose and do the look back at some of these incidents where there was a weapon involved or identified, it's very normal kid stuff, right? Teenager stuff of a love interest involved or so-and-so, there was an insult perceived or something that's just back in the day before just general access to weapons probably would have resulted in some pushing, shoving, maybe a fist fight, and that's it. And kids are still kids. They still are going through different emotional phases as they're growing, and the proliferation of weapons everywhere now means that there's this extra dimension of if you worry that someone else that you're potentially having a beef with might have a weapon, of course, your thought might be that I need to protect myself as well when the stakes have been ratcheted up. And so we have really focused on ensuring that schools are safe spaces. Schools are sanctuaries within that. We need to create more safe spaces throughout the community. We've been working, again, hand in hand and in brainstorming and conversation with our young people about how to identify ways that even on the commute from home to school, whether it's through certain key routes or in front of different MBTA stations, there's more of an adult presence from that school to be able to identify and just have that safety there. In some ways, it's kind of it feels like a chicken and egg situation, and we just need everyone to feel secure and comfortable so that everybody has can trust that their safety won't be in jeopardy, because once we start seeing this ratcheting up, it very quickly escalates across the board. We have had, we're a school district of 50,000 young people. There have been incidents in a small number of schools that have affected a small number of families. They have been immediately addressed. My kids are in the Boston Public Schools, and I feel very happy and confident in their safety and their well-being and the nurturing environment that they are in every day. We work to make sure that that is true for every single child. But sometimes I think the narrative gets skewed because one incident in one location then gets highlighted in such a way that people apply those statistics across the board as well.
Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here in Studio 2 for Monday with the mayor. Let's have a little fun. We talked about Thanks Sushi Giving. We talked a little bit about your weekend. I have a couple of other key quite very important questions for you. Flavor of pie.
Ooh. I mean, I'm sometimes a traditionalist. You can't go wrong with apple pie. Depending on the, I don't know, sometimes depending on the mood, pumpkin or no pumpkin, I really like pecan pie as well for a little savory and sweet altogether.
So pecan pie, definitely not double crust. But if it's a fruit pie, are you a two crust,
what
one
that
crust?
Mean? What does two crust mean?
So a crust across the top as well, or just the crust underneath?
Yeah, wait, you have a pie without a crust on the top?
Oh,
just
yeah.
Open?
Open, yeah. Open apple pie or a little crumble on
like
top.
I like the extra carbs.
Me too. And frankly, honestly, I prefer the crust to the filling, except blueberry. All right. And do you, when you do the more traditional Thanksgiving meal, stuffing or no?
Stuffing, yes.
In the bird or not in the bird?
This
seems to be like a huge
not
thing
in the
for
bird.
People. Not in the bird.
You don't want to risk something not going right with the temperatures inside the bird.
You're emphatic about that. All right. So listen, we talked about the Green New Deal at the top of the show. However, in the last few minutes, your office has released a press release. And so, I mean, you're sitting right here. Why would I not?
We were trying to get it out earlier.
Why would I not ask you about it when you are literally sitting right here? And this has to do with energy efficiency, renewable energy in municipal buildings. So why don't you just give us the quick headline on that?
Yeah, this has been a years-long crusade of mine and so many across the city. We need to be walking the walk when it comes to how city government participates in the market as well. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, our green, clean electricity programs for residents are already saving people a lot of money, but we haven't applied that directly yet to our city buildings because it just takes, you know, the scale of energy that you need to run City Hall and all of our schools and community centers and libraries, police stations, fire stations. It's a lot. So we are releasing a new RFP, a request for proposals, to procure our electricity differently for city buildings. This will be a huge step that we intend to connect to green jobs and the growing green economy here, and just make sure that we are putting our money where our mouth is as well.
So one of the things that struck me, if I understand the press release correctly, is that you're looking to kind of move the market. That if the city of Boston can guarantee providers that you will use a large set of municipal buildings to purchase renewable energy, you think that will increase the supply and the businesses in the marketplace. Is that right?
Yeah. And our goal is really to create those jobs and that supply as locally as possible. You know, for many years now, you can purchase credits, and sometimes these credits are from a solar farm that is in the south or far away, and there's not that direct link that we want to create with jobs for our residents here. So it takes a lot of energy to heat and cool our many, many city buildings that are often running 24 hours a day in some cases, our fire stations and police stations. And so we want to make sure that we're doing our part. We've seen huge benefits already from applying this approach to food purchasing. Our $18 million Boston Public Schools food contract, when we applied new parameters to how we would prioritize the winners of those bids, you know, preferencing locally produced, locally funded, racial equity, and environmental sustainability, that led us to our City Fresh Foods contract, Roxbury-based business, where many of the workers packing those meals for Boston Public School students are, in fact, BPS parents themselves. And so that's the kind of virtuous circle that we're looking to create here.
So one more thing on sort of your climate initiatives, because we did reach out to our listeners who belong to our texting group. And for you out there, if you have not yet joined our texting group, we read what you have to say. We bring those questions forward. We want to hear from you. You text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. And you can join us. And if I said that number too fast, go to our about page at radioboston.org and you can find all the information there too. So Benjamin of Boston said, how is the new urban forestry initiative going? I'm excited to see some rain sinks and tree bump outs in my neighborhood.
Yes. Well, there's a couple of initiatives connected to that. So one is, as Benjamin mentions, we have really tried to get at the root causes, pun intended, of why trees have had a harder time surviving in our tree pits along sidewalks. The mortality rate of our trees has been very high. So as much as we've been planting and planting, we've not increased our tree canopy over the last decade or so. And much of this is staffing in the organization. We had for a long time just one certified arborist for the entire city's 30,000 street trees and all of our parks trees, whereas many cities have 15, 20 people on a team like that to be able to really prune care for and maintain. So we're still hiring for many of those positions. If you know someone or if you have an interest in this area, you can go on the city's website and apply. We're staffing up for next season. It's getting a little bit into the colder weather in terms of the cycles where you know trees really get into the ground. But the infrastructure piece is really important as well. We have a new director of green infrastructure, and we have changed our city's default approach to how we fix sidewalks and curb cuts. Whereas before, the standard was that you just order concrete and it, you know, gets poured how it gets poured. Now the default is five different options that can either have grass or trees to absorb water, or porous pavement, or another kind of tree pit that's built in there. It makes our streets safer for pedestrians and, again, also helps with these climate benefits as well.
So that's one of the changes you made in your first year. You just talked about the fact that you're still doing some hiring. The slowness of hiring is something that you've talked about that kind of characterized your first year. On a speed of, you know, 0 to 40 miles per hour, how much did the hiring, you know, challenges of this marketplace slow down your speed in your first year?
I think there are a lot of dynamics here. I will say that the difference between now having our school superintendent, police commissioner, director of chief of planning, fire commissioner, having them in place has just We are now operating on an entirely different plane than before. And it wasn't just that these organizations were left with a little bit of instability and often transitions that they had weathered over multiple administrations now. But the work that was happening, you know, there's always this question of what will the long-term approach be? And so there was a hesitation from many different levels of when do we actually lock down the approach and just start running at the solutions. So the overlapping hiring processes, multiple national hiring searches at the same time was quite intense. It's also a difficult time to be in government. You see what's happening on social media with the downfall of Twitter and nationwide normalization of hate and protests that verge on harassment.
It can be a little bit
difficult sell to say, okay, we really need you right now in public service. Now, the folks that we have today, we couldn't be luckier to have people who said, this is a difficult moment that calls for extraordinary leadership, and I'm committed to pouring everything into that. And so we've landed exactly where we needed to be, but there's just waves of hiring now, where now that the cabinet is hired, they're filling out their own leadership teams, who are filling out mid-level positions, who are then continuing to fill frontline positions. So we will, I think, forever be in a hiring cycle here.
So, you know, the whole how would you grade your first year thing has gotten a little trite. So I'm going to do this a little different because you care about early education and care. So I'm going to ask you for one moment in your first year that for you in your heart was a gold star sticker. And then I'm going to ask you for one red X.
Okay.
So the gold star sticker moment for you, you know, in your gut for you.
There are many, many. I think what has been most rewarding for me is that even though, you know, it's hard for anything to change wildly in just one year, but I think we have begun to demonstrate and shift the expectations and the belief in what is possible versus impossible in this city.
What do you mean by that?
One gold star moment, I think, for our entire team was how the city came together, City Hall and city government came together handling the Orange Line shutdown. It was basically a two-week notice period. We had theoretically discussed the idea in just a few weeks before that, but had no idea it would be coming so quickly. And in about 15 days, every single department was involved in some way of pulling together what would have been an impossible feat otherwise, doing the outreach, coordinating, protecting our small businesses, making sure people had information, painting dozens of new bus lanes and bike lanes to try to mitigate what would have been a really disastrous situation for people to be locked in without transportation.
So why were you so proud of that?
Because this is an area where it would have been very easy for city government to walk away, right? This is a state's problem. The MBTA has its own leadership team, a different level of government, and, you know, it looks like it's going to be really bad. Why don't we just duck for cover and try not to get splashed by the negative consequences of that? And instead, our team really stepped up and say, we're not only going to take on the risk of owning some of this, but we don't have any other choice because this is the day-to-day well-being and economic opportunity for our residents, whether people can get to school or pick up their kids. And I think it showed in even just 2 weeks how much we can do as a region when we all get on the same page and really decide to pursue something big.
How about that, Red X?
I think there have been moments where I wish we had communicated better, and I take full responsibility for sometimes, you know, there's so many things up in the air at the same time, and there's always something new to highlight and announce, but a lot of work continues in the background of things that had been talked about months ago that are in fact now having a real impact day after day after day. I think in some ways, didn't claim the right framing for our efforts at Masks and Casts. I mean, it is night and day from where we were a year ago. It is 80%, 90% even better than where we started a year ago, where people were dying on the streets and there were fires and rampant diseases spread from a rodent infestation and just widespread human trafficking in structures that we didn't really know what was going on inside. And to now be in a place where there's still many, many people who need services and more people have come now knowing that this is a city that is committed to providing services. I'm really proud of the work that our team has done, but I think not sharing that along the way and I think not communicating more of what we were measuring, what we were learning along the way, led to quite a difficult set of public conversations about that. And, you know, we strive to, certainly it is not solved. We strive to keep getting better every single day, but we really have done something different and that the rest of the country is looking to in terms of how we are addressing homelessness and the opioid crisis, and I need to do a better job of sharing that.
Who or what did that do a disservice to?
It's done a disservice to the residents who are unhoused and I think get swept up in an us versus them mindset. I mean, the stories of these are people who are toppling every set of odds stacked against them, who are inspiring in every single way when you can go from one unexpected incident in your life, suddenly being on the street, falling into cycles of broken systems, and then moving from a tent into transitional housing to then holding a job, having a stable life and taking care of your medical needs. That is something that most of us would be incapable of doing over the course of just a year. And so highlighting the incredible stories and victories that have happened there, and then showing, you know, that is really the proof that this works. And for all of the people who remain on that wait list, you know, we can do this. We can do something on the scale of the Orange Line shutdown. We can do something on the scale of new facilities that are being stood up for migrant families across the state, just like this, with almost no notice at all. And this is a choice that we're making as a society to let one city try to do their best and address it and put their resources towards it. We need a larger approach and commitment here.
So we're going to take a break in our conversation in just a second. Two quick questions for you before we do. First, have you and the governor-elect sat down yet? Have the two of you had a face-to-face since
the
election?
We have not yet. We have had a lot of messages back and forth and different conversations. We've been at a couple events together that have been wonderful. But I know she needs time to get her transition up and running, to enjoy her Thanksgiving. And so I'm ready and eager when we will get the chance to sit down.
And so there's not a plan on the books to do that yet?
We were aiming for this week, so we'll see. I think there's a lot happening this week across the city, but sometime in the next couple of weeks, I'm sure that will happen.
Here in Studio 2, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. It is Monday with the mayor, and we'd like to bring you some more questions from listeners who joined our texting group by texting Boston to 617-760-3832. And then we said, hey, what questions do you have for the mayor? So let's do a little bit of a lightning round. I'll read them fast. You give quick answers.
Great.
We'll do two or three. Okay, so Kelly of Roxbury, what's the progress on the Jazz Urbane Club planned for the first floor of the bowling building in Nubian Square?
Oh, we're so excited about that. It'll be a beautiful, beautiful space. We are trying to finalize the liquor license approvals up at the State House. And so we're hopeful that that should be coming soon and really grateful for all who've been involved.
And Kelly also wants to know, how's the city planning to work with the NAACP National Convention scheduled for the summer of 2023?
Yes, this is very, very exciting. A huge opportunity for Boston. We had a visit from the national board, the national NAACP board, a few weeks ago, just touring some of the sites. Our goal is to ensure that the city of Boston not only showcases all that we have to offer during the convention, but that we have a series of programming leading up to that, and that we will be able to have the impact of this last long after this convention as well. But a lot going on there.
Michael Curry is on the national board, former leader here on your transition team. Is he working with you on the preparations for the convention?
Yes, both the we're very blessed to have multiple Boston folks involved in the national board, Mr. Cofield, Mr. Curry, and as well as our local Boston NAACP branch hosting. So President Tanisha Sullivan's been very involved as well.
All right. So Kathleen of Jamaica Plain says the roads in Boston are in terrible shape, especially for cyclists. Boston has the potential to be the best city in the country for bicycling. I know Mayor Wu is working hard to increase infrastructure, but we need to move faster. Our bike lines are full of cracks and potholes, making cycling super unsafe. So your response to Kathleen and JP?
Yeah, I agree. And we are working to make sure we can go faster. I experience this as well. You can have a bike lane where a small divot or pothole is tremendously dangerous for cyclists. And so we have many, many cyclists within our administration, from our chief of streets to chief of staff and everyone in between. So this is a priority for us, and we'll keep going.
So Westy in Boston says, municipalities are highly impacted by new immigrants. Boston has a long, successful history of welcoming and assisting newcomers with ESL, job training. Should the flow of asylum seekers at the southern border be brought to Boston and many cities for aid rather than just Texas cities and detention camps?
Well, we are, in fact, already receiving and welcoming many of the new migrant families to Boston. Some of this is directly, as we experienced in Martha's Vineyard, from the border. But some is also just a flow of residents who go to other cities who eventually make their way to Boston for connections with family or services. There have been hundreds of new arrivals to our city in the last couple of months. I'm really proud of the work that our team is doing. We're partnering with the state, working hand in hand, new locations to welcome people in and provide that first set of days. Temporary housing and food and accommodations have been set up in Boston and in other places across Massachusetts. And we continue to see families coming in and to continue advocating for the federal government to provide some recognition that the system needs tweaks in other parts that are impacting cities. For example, the long, long processing times of asylum seekers through the legal immigration process means that people are kind of in this shadowy gray area for a long time, when there should be resources devoted to managing that part of the legal system that then will really support cities' efforts to be able to be welcoming homes for everyone.
So this is one of those intergovernmental issues, mm-hmm. right, where there's a city response, a state response, a federal response. The Baker administration came under some fire for the lack of awareness by cities and towns that they were housing families in hotels in places like a Methuen or a Plymouth. They've now asked for more resources from the federal government. The state has. They're setting up kind of a welcoming and transitional mm-hmm. center at Devens. Do you feel like the state has the capacity to support cities and towns sufficiently? And is there anything different you want to see from a Healey administration than you've seen so far on this?
What has happened in the last couple weeks has been great and amazing in terms of there's been a real acceleration of the urgency and actual housing spaces created and coordination among different providers. I think part of that was that over the summer, our hospitals were absorbing much of the intake and community organizations were absorbing much of the intake, connecting people to various shelter options or housing. And when those frontline organizations reached capacity, then I think we saw the state really step into leadership on this. I worry that the flow will continue for the next few months is what all of the advocates are telling us, is that we will need to be ahead of the curve even in being able to absorb this capacity. And, you know, just to flag that, what we see in terms of the speed of action for our immigrant families is exactly what it should be, and we need to do even more. And there are many other communities also that need to see that same speed of action, right? Again, going back to our unhoused residents at Mass and Cass, going to many of residents who are on wait lists for public housing, we have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time and take care of multiple communities in this way.
Shifting gears, how concerned are you for residents about utility bills? You know, some of WBUR's own reporting, price of fuel oil up 72%. For some utility customers, electricity more than 100%, gas nearly 30%. How worried are you? And as I understand it, you're using some ARPA funds on this.
Yeah, this is, it's make or break for residents, especially headed into the colder months when you need to keep the heat on, headed into the holiday season when things are tighter in general. To have the increases come right now is the worst possible time. And so we're doing everything we can to spread the word. Again, our city community choice electricity program is already more than $35 a month cheaper than the basic utilities plan.
How fast and easy is it to get on that plan if people aren't now?
I'm going to double check the website. I think it's boston.gov/BCCE.
We'll double check it.
Okay. For Boston Community Choice Electricity. You just fill out a form. The plan was that most residents should already be on this plan already, because when we implemented this, one feature of municipal aggregation plans is that everyone who is not already on a third-party electricity supplier gets automatically shifted to a city's plan. So if you had been on the Eversource plan 2 years ago and you didn't sign up for any extra plan, you should already be on this, but it's good to verify and just to double check. The people I worry about most, and this is often our seniors, often our multilingual residents, are those who have been persuaded to join, really taken advantage of, to join one of these third-party competitive supply companies' plans. There are companies that will go door-to-door promising that it's a better deal, and then when you sign on the line, it is in fact a predatory, it's a scam. And so these suppliers, this is prime environment for people to be taken advantage of as prices are fluctuating wildly. And so we really encourage everyone to get on the city's plan, because it is vetted, it is trusted, it is more stable through the end of next year, and our prices are guaranteed to be lower than the default utilities plan. We have a couple different options of the city's plan as well. Our basic plan is the one that is cheapest and has the most cost savings, but we go all the way up to 100% green plan that the city has, which is still $11 a month cheaper than the utilities plan in this moment and is entirely wind, solar, and other green electricity sources.
And you're right, it's boston.gov/BCCE. All right, I want to talk to sports for just a second. First, World Cup is happening. Are you watching? Are you a soccer person?
Yes, it is constantly on at home. The kids have, they made these little bracket sheets and they're crossing off and editing. There's been some exciting upsets and... Yeah, I my kids play soccer. That's probably their fascination right now. And so it's been fun watching them get to see it on a large scale. And so we'll get to host next year as well.
Yeah, so that's 2026,
sorry,
right?
Next time around.
So that's the thing, right? So now you're watching other places host, right? Boston's going to get four to six matches on average. What are you learning from watching other cities host about what you want when it comes to Boston in 2026?
Well, it's been, I think we have some built-in benefits that it won't be scorching hot and therefore the game's having to be played late at night and in the winter. And I think there's a real opportunity. You see people coming and through their country affiliation or their team affiliations really, in fact, connecting with the entire community. So I know many of the Gillette will be a big host site, but I hope the city will be able to tap into that. We did host one watch party for the U.S. versus England game a couple days ago. There were lines around the block, and that went really well. Any opportunity we have to build a sense of community here and help support youth sports in the process, I think there's a lot that we'll be able to connect to this effort in a few years and make sure that, again, there's lasting impact for the city of Boston.
So one more thing on sports. We've got about 2 minutes left. Celtics and the Bruins are playing well. The Bruins had the Mitch Miller scandal where they signed a player who it turned out had done terrible long-term bullying of a young person of color with intellectual developmental disabilities. On the Celtics side, forward Jaylen Brown shares a video link of a group identified as racist, homophobic, and anti-Semitic by the Anti-Defamation League. He's very clear later he was not trying to endorse them. He was trying to show up for Kyrie Irving, who was returning to the Nets but has also been condemned for anti-Semitic comments. The teams represent the Boston brand. Do you talk with the teams in moments like this, and how are you feeling about how the brand's being represented?
I think in the case of the Bruins, it was really powerful to see the players step out, the captain and all the kind of longtime players saying, we take our character and integrity really seriously on this team. And that was a moment where I was proud to hear their statements and glad that the ownership and the team also came around and stuck by them. I think on the, my husband took the kids last night to the game. We have season tickets. We're at TD Garden very, very often. And it just goes to show how much our sports teams and athletes who are often young people, right? Now I'm at the age where they're younger than me by and large. They are such role models and have the potential to really shape our culture and conversation in so many ways. They really use that platform for good often, right? All of our sports teams teamed up last year to really take on destigmatize mental health. They've been in our schools. They're active partners, and we'll strive to see more of that.
All right. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu from Mondays with the Mayor. Always appreciate having you here in Studio 2, and happy belated Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks, Tiziana.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.